American Literature Prediscussion Podcast 5, The Scarlet Letter, Chapters 13 to 18. I'm assuming you've started the second half of the book, you've noticed the changes that take place during this middle part of the novel, and you're wondering what to do with all this. Well, let's start with an important scene from Chapter 12, where we have an extended moment on the platform of shame with Dimmesdale gazing at that eerie, heavenly light, Hester's egg gleaming beside him, and Pearl's standing there with both of her parents. Now, we might think that this scene is healing, suggesting a motion towards community or family or normalcy or something like that. But Pearl has asked if Dimmesdale will stand there with them at noon, and he says no. And just in case we miss the point, in this scene we also have little Pearl pointing her finger towards Chillingworth. On the symbolic level, that comet with the eerie red light that it shows is telling us that something is wrong. So chapter 13 starts with the aftermath of this. Hester is assessing Dimmesdale. Hawthorne writes, "His nerves seemed absolutely destroyed. His moral force was abased into more than childish weakness. It groveled helpless on the ground, even while his intellectual faculties retained their pristine strength or had perhaps acquired a morbid energy." Now this is Hester looking at Dimmesdale and thinking about him. Chapter 13 is called Another View of Hester. And here we read that, quote, "Hester Prynne did not occupy precisely the same position in which we beheld her during the earlier periods of her ignominy." That's a fancy word for shame or losing your good name. We see things are changing for Hester. The people in Salem are starting to say that A stands for able, and no, the spelling A-B-E-L, and it's capitalized. This is the good son of Adam and Eve, whose sacrifice was pleasing to God. Abel was killed by the jealous son Cain, because God did not accept Cain's sacrifices. Okay. Literary questions are rarely ever worth exploring if there's an obviously right answer. So let's explore a thorny question. Near the end of chapter 13, let's look at the third paragraph from the end. Hawthorne tells us of Hester, "At times a fearful doubt strove to possess her soul, whether it were not better to send Pearl at once to heaven and go herself to such futurity as eternal justice should provide." Okay, now wait a minute. We learn from the meeting with the governor that Pearl is the one thing that keeps Hester from chucking it all and heading to those midnight meetings in the forest. So why does Hawthorne choose to tell us this detail? How does this detail affect our understanding of Hester? Well, here's a hint. Look at the next two paragraphs, too. Remember, this paragraph or this chapter is called Another View of Hester. What's true of Hester at one point in the novel is not always true of her at every point. Chapter 15 focuses on Hester and Pearl, and it also expands upon the role that nature plays in the book. We see, after her meeting with Chillingworth, Hester is half surprised that when Chillingworth walks across the grass, he's not killing it. And Hester imagines that there's a shadow following Chillingworth wherever he walks. This chapter tells us that while we've so far associated Pearl with sunshine, she's also seized a live horseshoe by the tail, made prize of several five fingers, and laid out a jellyfish to melt in the warm sun. In this scene, she also throws rocks at birds, but to her credit, when she wounds one of them, she does feel bad about it. At any rate, something in Pearl is destructive and disordered. Though she's physically beautiful and she's perceptive, it may even be that disorder that prompts her to ask those difficult questions that in many ways serve as the voice of truth in this novel. For instance, she asks questions that link Hester's A with the minister's habit of placing his hand over his heart. During chapter 16, we see a little bit more about the sunshine. Just in case we didn't notice, Hawthorne has Pearl say, Mother, the sunshine, does not love you. It runs away and hides itself because it is afraid of something on your bosom. But I am a child. I wear nothing on my bosom yet. Now, of Chillingworth, Hester determines, he has done me worse wrong than I him. This is really a turning point in the novel. It really drives the next step in the plot. This is the chapter where Hester lies to Pearl about the Scarlet Letter and threatens to lock Pearl in a closet if she asks foolish questions again. Now, I think it's natural for us to applaud Hester for, you know, getting courage, for becoming strong. Her resolve is building in this chapter, but look what's happening. She's being false. She's silencing Pearl. She's becoming more like a hypocritical, strict Puritan. The whole book, of course, is engineered to make us root for Hester. We see her standing alone against a crowd of somber and unforgiving Puritans in the first chapter, but lying to Pearl and threatening her. I mean, Pearl is the book's only truly free character. Why is Hawthorne doing this at this point in the novel? We've spoken so far about Dimmesdale's suffering, about how his health and morals are being eaten away by the strain of keeping up false appearances. But when Hester meets up with Dimmesdale, or she kind of stalks him for a couple days and finally gets a good look at him, we read, to Hester's eye, the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale exhibited no symptom of positive and vivacious suffering, except that, as Little Pearl had remarked, he kept his hand over his heart. Hester sees that Dimmesdale is not benefiting from his suffering. It's not positive. The suffering is needlessly prolonged by Chillingworth. Now, this realization, together with Hester's opinion that Chillingworth is the most guilty of the three, really sets the next step in motion. In her conversation with Dimmesdale, Hester repeats a statement that both of them had said, what we did had a consecration of its own. And Dimmesdale here agrees, and we can really see their feelings for each other coming back quickly. Now, I want to jump back to the previous chapter a bit, to this extended passage with the brook, which babbles sadly, according to Hawthorne. This same brook is interpreted as sad by both Pearl and Hester. Now, to be truthful, I love the sound of running water. I personally can't imagine how the sound of running water could possibly be mournful. But it's necessary for the story that we see this river as sad. Pearl and Hester see it that way. It's not a symbol of escape. It's not a purifying water. We've seen this water in connection with Pearl as mysterious and risky, but dangerous and fascinating to Pearl as well. Now again, just in case we missed it, Hawthorne tells us, and this is right before Dimmesdale arrives, tells us, Pearl resembled the brook inasmuch as the current of her life gushed from a wellspring as mysterious and had flowed through sense shadowed as heavily with gloom. But unlike the little stream, we're still quoting the same passage, she danced and sparkled and prattled airily along her course. As the novel starts working its way towards what looks like a resolution with this perfectly sensible plan that the three of them should run away and start over somewhere else, Hawthorne carefully inserts a contrasting image. Now, I kind of tease Hawthorne a bit by saying he's never subtle. He's more subtle about this one. But look at what he says. This is the scene where Hester and Dimmesdale are really starting to make these plans together, and they're celebrating this hope that comes with this plan. But Hawthorne writes, the forest was obscure around them and creaked with a blast that was passing through it. The boughs were tossing heavily above their heads, while one solemn old tree groaned dolefully to another, as if telling the sad story of the pair that sat beneath. Now, this is setting us up for the next chapter, which is called A Flood of Sunshine. I mean, with a happy title like that, we really can't help but share the hopes of these two. But what do we make of this obscure forest, this blast, these creakings and groanings that are going on in the forest? I mean, this forest is, at the very best, it's not sending, you know, it's not giving us butterflies and rainbows. It's mixed signals at best. Now, in this encounter between Hester and Dimmesdale, some exciting stuff happens. Hester tosses her A onto the grass, and she lets her hair down, literally. Dimmesdale speaks to her affectionately. We see some, you know, some smiles and some warmth. They begin to plan a new life together. We see Hester looking beautiful again, and Dimmesdale starts to have a reason to live again. Yet, Hawthorne in chapter 18 tells us, "And be the stern and sad truth spoken, that the breach which guilt has once made into the human soul is never in this mortal state repaired." The breach is never repaired, Hawthorne tells us. Now, is this really Hawthorne's point of view? It comes in a paragraph that's describing Dimmesdale's thought process, but Hawthorne still labels it as the stern and sad truth that Dimmesdale reflects on this, that Dimmesdale never could restore his soul in this community anyway, so he has to flee. Now, I think a lesser novelist would have those refreshing waters just sweep that A away, along with, you know, inhibitions and sins, and probably Dimmesdale and Hester would kiss under a waterfall, and it would just be a very, very different novel at this point. This renewed love of Hester and Dimmesdale, it brings sunlight to their hearts, and you have this booming, creaking, groaning forest is, according to Hawthorne anyway, it's withholding its blessing. The forest, just like the meteor previously, seems to know that something is wrong, something that the characters don't know. We notice that, I think. We notice something is wrong. On some level, anyway, Hawthorne is expecting us to notice that. Now, Pearl, meanwhile, has decorated her hair and her clothes with flowers. Hawthorne tells us she resembles a wood spirit. Now, earlier she was herding the wildlife by the stream, but now in the forest she seems, at the very least, the forest creatures are interested in her. A squirrel throws a nut at her, but otherwise the animals seem to at least acknowledge her presence. Hawthorne admits that this detail about a wolf letting Pearl pet its head is probably, it's probably not true. But Hawthorne does tell us that the mother forest and these wild things which it nourished all recognized a kindred wilderness in the human child. This chapter ends with Hester and Dimmesdale presenting themselves to Pearl as a unit. Pearl, who Hawthorne tells us has dressed herself in these flowers and she's, quote, became a nymph child or an infant dryad or whatever else was in closest sympathy with the antique wood. In her role as representative of nature, in her role that we've seen her in before as this innocent speaker of truths, how does Pearl respond? We don't see that response until chapter 19, and so I'm not going to cover it in this pre-discussion podcast, but I did want to talk about the setup to Pearl's response. Okay, that does it for this podcast. Happy reading, and I'll see you in class.